You're not an electrical engineer, are you?
Yeah, let's get started with what has happened in Iran, in Tehran, and in Beirut. Two important figures have been assassinated. What's your take on what has happened?
Well, I think this is very dangerous and important. I believe it represents an effort by Prime Minister Netanyahu, which he began 9 months ago, to entangle the United States in Israel's wars with the Palestinians and its neighbors. And I think if you are serious about negotiating a hostage release and a ceasefire, you don't murder your opposite number at the negotiating table. So any doubt that anyone may have had about whether Israel was sincere in pursuing an agreement with Palestinians has now been eliminated. It is not pursuing an agreement. It is instead prosecuting a war of extermination, annihilation, a genocide. And it had said from the beginning that even if there was an agreement, it reserved the right both to resume the war at a time of its choosing and to murder Palestinian officials wherever in the world they might be. This is an indication of that Israel basically is prepared to commit any crime at all. It feels no constraints. And by attacking Ismail Haniyeh and murdering him in Tehran, Israel has, of course, violated Iranian sovereignty. And the leader of Iran has said that Israel will pay a heavy price for this. We don't know what Iran will do, but it will probably be almost certainly be something military. And Hezbollah, Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, has said in the past that if there were an attack on Beirut, he would attack Tel Aviv. So I think this is a very dangerous moment. We must wait to see what the Palestinians and the Iranians and the Lebanese, all of whom are being brought into a war with Israel, now do.
Yeah. We've just learned that Iran, in a letter to the UN Security Council, they're stressing a serious violation against the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Iran. And they're talking about they will authorize a special military operation against the enemy. And in your opinion, what they're asking for from the UN Security Council?
Well, I note that Lebanon plans to do the same thing. That is to protest the Israeli action to the Security Council. Of course, one of the objectives here is to align international opinion behind Iran and Lebanon when they retaliate, which they will. Now we know that Iran plans to use military means to retaliate, which it has done before, of course. Quite effectively. That is what we know. But I think the main objective here is simply to position Iran and Lebanon better to conduct that reprisal and to warn the world publicly about what Israel has done. It appears there's no crime Israel is unprepared to commit. Genocide, murder, assassination, false flag operations. And by the way, I think there is severe doubt about whether Hezbollah, in fact, was responsible for the Falak 1 rocket that is alleged to have fallen in the Golan Heights. Hezbollah has never attacked Syrians. The people there are Syrian under Israeli occupation. The United States is alone pretty much in recognizing Israel's attempted annexation of the Golan Heights. International law says that it's part of Syria. There's no reason for Hezbollah to attack there. And also, Hezbollah has been very careful to attack military installations, not civilian installations. So I suspect that is all too often the case. Israel has lied. for political convenience. And the United States has idiotically signed on to the lie. So this attack on Beirut, in addition to being egregious, the violation of international law, is not justified by reprisal, the right of retaliation at all.
In your opinion, what has happened in the United States gave some sort of permission to Netanyahu and his administration to carry out at the same time in Beirut, in Tehran, in Syria, because these are the same kind of activities that they're doing.
Well, this exposes the tremendous contradiction in U.S. policy. On the one hand, the United States says that we want to see the war de-escalate and end. On the other hand, we provide the weapons to escalate it and continue it. There's no coherence here at all. It is completely incoherent and self-contradictory. We all know that if the United States were to end its arms supplies to Israel or provide a credible threat to do so, that Israel would not be able to conduct the war anymore. So the United States is enabling genocide, murder, and attacks on other countries. And here, I know there is an important point to bear in mind. I don't know of any other country besides Israel that feels free to attack its neighbors, bomb them, strafe them, fire rockets at them, murder their leaders at will. If the Russians do something against a hospital in Ukraine, there's an immediate international outcry from the West. When Israel destroys all the hospitals in Gaza, nobody says very much of anything. So there is a double standard, and I think the world recognizes hypocrisy when it sees it. So this has been very injurious to American credibility, and it has totally destroyed the credibility of anything Israel says.
Yeah. The government in Qatar, they're talking about how we can negotiate when one side is assassinating the other side. And we know that it seems that Ismail Haniyeh was a moderate figure in Hamas, and he would be beneficial for any sort of negotiations between Hamas and Israel. In your opinion, what was the main goal after, if Israel has decided to do that, what was the main reason in their mind?
Well, I suspect, as I said earlier, if you are serious about negotiating with someone, you don't murder them. So the point that the Qatari foreign minister made is absolutely correct. This throws the whole question of the talks that we have been participating in with Israel and Hamas into doubt. And if I were Bill Burns, the director of the CIA, who has been deputized to conduct these talks for the United States, I would feel completely betrayed by Israel, which did not inform the United States of what it planned to do, and which must have understood, because Israelis are very smart, that by doing this, they ran the risk of totally ending the negotiations. I suspect Mr. Netanyahu wants Hamas to break off the talks, because that would shift the blame for the continued hostage situation from him to Hamas. Israel is now incredibly divided. There is a near mutiny in the armed forces, which do not believe in the strategy-free war of extermination that Mr. Netanyahu has ordered and this extremist cabinet has approved. The Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox in Israel, who risk now being conscripted, are up in arms about that. We just saw a riot at the worst prison in Israel for Palestinians, in which the army found itself fighting the right-wing settler movement and members of the cabinet who were attacking the prison. Of course, the reason for the attack was that the army decided to arrest 9 Israeli soldiers, prison guards, who had raped and otherwise abused a Palestinian inmate, which is a war crime, by the way. Typically, asked whether this was a war crime, the spokesman for the Department of State, U.S. Department of State, couldn't bring himself to say that. He said, well, I assume it's a violation of Israeli law. If anyone else in the world did what the Israelis have just done, it would be called a war crime. So again, our credibility is being destroyed by the irresponsible actions of Israelis and our condoning them.
Yeah. The question is how the Biden administration right now is trying to manage the situation. Blinken said that we don't know, we didn't know that it's going to happen. Oh, they don't know, or they're denying, we can say that they're denying that Israel did that. How do you find the policy right now in Washington?
Well, I think it is a policy of denial. It is support for Israel. While we occasionally issue mild criticism, it's particularly ironic because we accuse the Chinese, who are carrying on a normal relationship with Russia, of supporting Russia against Ukraine and NATO. But here we are supplying weapons, paying for genocide, and providing political defenses for the indefensible acts of Israel, and somehow we're not on Israel's side. I think the whole problem with the negotiations from the beginning has been that the United States is not, in any respect, a credible mediator. We are on the side of the Israelis. Everybody knows that. So everything that the United States has been talking about has been the hostages and a ceasefire to get the hostages out. What about the human rights of Palestinians? What about the genocide? What about the right of self-determination of the Palestinians? None of this is ever mentioned. So our policy is essentially untenable. It is directed by domestic political considerations. In foreign policy terms, it's a catastrophe for us.
Yeah. There is a news coming out. It says that the United States and United Kingdom is sending, they're sending their warships toward the Israeli coast in the Eastern Mediterranean. And if they didn't know that, and why they start doing this in order to help Israel if something big happened in that region?
Well, this will be explained as it was previously as an effort to prevent a war between Israel and Hezbollah. But it is clearly a gesture of support for Israel. And it makes the U.S. ships a potential target for Hezbollah. I don't think Hezbollah wants a war, certainly not with the United States. And I don't think they want a war with Israel. But Israel is trying to goad them into an attack on it. And by extension, the United States, maybe the UK as well, in order to widen the war, in order to bring the United States and the UK in. Nothing would be worse from the point of view of American and British national interests than to do that. And I think also there is a domestic political element here. Kamala Harris clearly has some feeling for the Palestinians and has expressed it. Mr. Biden has done no such thing. But the essence of the policy has not changed. And there's no indication that if elected, she would change it. Mr. Trump has said to Israel, you should finish the job and end the war. Well, by that he means finish the extermination of the Palestinians. We now have in Gaza, not just what some people are now estimating, maybe ultimately as many as 600,000 dead. There are 21,000 babies who have been identified. There are another 25,000 that are missing and presumably under the rubble. The figures that the health ministry in Gaza has given out represent people who've been positively identified. But there are a huge number of people who've not been identified. Now we have an outbreak of polio. What does the Israeli army do? They blow up the water supply to enable the polio to spread farther. This is genocide, clear and simple. If it is indeed ultimately 600,000 Palestinians who perish from bombs, gunfire, disease, and starvation, because about 500,000 Palestinians are now literally on the brink of death from starvation, then there will be no doubt at all about this. And I think all of what has been happening with assassinations is an effort to divert attention from the international court's determination that Mr. Netanyahu and others in Israel are war criminals and should be arrested and brought to trial, like some of the people in Yugoslavia were, for less serious acts of genocide. This is political diversion through military or intelligence action.
From what we've seen so far from Iran and Hezbollah, in your opinion, how they're going to manage the situation? We know that they're not looking after any sort of escalation with Israel, but how they can manage the situation right now?
Well, that's a problem for them. They don't want to do what Mr. Netanyahu wants them to do, which is to bring the United States and others into this war. They want to retaliate against Israel, of course. And I think Israel may have crossed a very serious line with these two assassinations. And that, you know, one of the immediate things that would occur to any leader of Hezbollah or Hamas, or for that matter, Iran, is Israel has been murdering people right and left. And the so-called resistance has not been reciprocating this action. They have not been killing cabinet members in Israel. They have not tried to assassinate Netanyahu. They have not done anything of that sort. They have continued to play as best they can by the laws of war. Now, I don't think October 7th proves the contrary, although it was accompanied by atrocities, which are very real. Not as real as the Israelis make them out to be. Mr. Netanyahu says, well, Hamas killed 1,200 people. No, Israel killed about 600, and people associated with Hamas killed another 600. But anyway, it's impossible at this point to unwrap all the lies and fabrications that have been developed to hide reality. But it is possible now that the self-imposed ban on counter-assassination that Iran, Hezbollah, Hamas have followed will now give way to a burst of assassinations. After all, I mean, Israel rules by terror. It tries to terrorize the Palestinians into leaving when it doesn't outright murder them. It tries to terrorize its neighbors with disproportionate retaliation for anything that happens. Why should the other side be restrained? I think this is probably a question that is being debated in Tehran and Beirut right now.
We know how close Ismail Haniyeh was to Turkey. And before this assassination, Turkey was talking about invading Israel and going after Netanyahu and his administration. Do you think that this would bring new escalations between Turkey and Iran and Israel?
Well, I'd note that Hamas is an outgrowth of the Muslim Brotherhood, which Turkey has historically supported. The Muslim Brotherhood is a democratic Islamist movement. It turned out when it was in power in Egypt that it was incompetent, but that doesn't mean it wasn't democratic. And Hamas, too, takes its power from the ballot box. It may be abusive, having been in power for as long as it has been, but its origins are democratic. That is not the case with Hezbollah, which is a very different sort of organization. So I don't believe that Turkey was seriously threatening to invade Israel. I think Mr. Erdogan is a very gifted politician, and he was making an appeal to the peoples of the region over the heads of their leaders, because many people, Arabs, Iranians, are very critical of their governments for not doing anything. They talk, but they don't do anything. And some of them, in fact, are colluding with Israel in other ways. So I think Mr. Erdogan was reaching over the heads of regional leaders to seek the approval and support of the populace in the region. And that is consistent with Turkey's objective of reestablishing its influence in the Middle East and reorienting its foreign policy away from Europe toward the Middle East. So I didn't take that threat very seriously, and I don't think Turkey is going to invade Israel. But we could see, if things continue to develop, the kind of thing we have seen between the United States and Russia, where the escalations by the United States and the attacks that Ukrainians are carrying out deep inside Russia have led Russia to adopt a policy of arming any and every opposition movement to the United States, wherever it is in the world. And so we see the embrace of North Korea by Russia, which was a direct response to the changed U.S. policy. We may see similar embrace of causes in the Middle East, which are anti-American, by the Turks. We may see a more active Iranian embrace of such movements than we have seen to date. I could think, for example, think of the Houthis, who have been very surprisingly effective in the conduct of their blockade in the Red Sea, with very little help from anyone. They have had some help from Iran. They may now get help from Turkey. You know, I think that war is in grave danger of widening.
Yeah, the other two important factors in the Middle East would be Saudi Arabia and UAE. How would this assassination affect their policy right now?
Very uncertain. Very uncertain. You have the Shia-Sunni divide here, and longstanding antipathy between hardline Sunnis in Saudi Arabia in particular. The UAE is much more pragmatic, but let's say the theocratic regime in Iran, various movements within the Islamic world that are Shia inspired, Hezbollah being the key one, which is seen as the enemy by both Saudi Arabia and the UAE. So I don't know what the effects will be. But I think it's becoming harder and harder for countries in the region to remain closely aligned with the United States. The United States is apparently willing to give Israel a blank check to do anything, no matter how heinous the crime. The United States will overlook it and continue to back Israel. So this makes it very difficult for people in Riyadh or Abu Dhabi to continue with a close relationship with the U.S. And there are problems in these relationships. For example, a committee of Congress decided that they would investigate an AI experiment in the UAE in which Microsoft is involved with the Chinese. And the UAE told them, you cannot investigate this. It's none of your business. Well, this is a tougher stance than the United States has been used to encountering in the region. So there are spillover effects, but it's too early to say what the long-term consequences might be.
When it comes to Washington and what's going on right now, it doesn't seem that this new escalation in the Middle East would benefit the Biden administration and whoever going to be the next Kamala Harris, if we consider her Kamala Harris as the presidential nominee for Democratic Party. How, in your opinion, why they couldn't convince Netanyahu not to go after some sort of escalation in the region, because that would be hugely against them, against their policies?
Because they're not serious, because there are people in the United States, committed Zionists, whether they're Jewish or Christian evangelicals, and there is an armaments industry, a military-industrial complex, which likes to sell weapons to Israel. And as long as Israel has every reason to believe that whatever it does, it will suffer no consequences from the United States has no leverage at all over Israel. This has been further complicated, I should say, by the fact that Mr. Biden has dropped out of the race for the presidency. He's now a lame duck. He's not a very well-respected lame duck. His reputation has been gravely damaged by his own performance in public. Kamala Harris has yet to define a separate policy for herself. There's every indication, in fact, as I said earlier, that she intends to continue with the broad outlines of the current policy, while tempering it a little bit in terms of wringing her hands and maybe shedding a tear or two for all the dead women and children in Gaza. The United States is now, I would say, almost completely isolated on this issue. Israel has crossed the line from being an outlaw to becoming a criminal in the minds of the world. I would expect we'll hear from the courts in The Hague, which can't afford to overlook all this. This is just so lawless as to be totally unacceptable.
It seems Netanyahu, considering his latest visit to the United States, he's doing everything possible before leaving office to bring the United States into the conflict. These are very desperate actions on his part.
Well, exactly. His own personal future is bound up with the continuation of the war. He has always had the Zionist desire to depopulate Palestine and resettle it with Jews from abroad, or people who claim to be Jews, because a lot of the Russians really aren't. They just want to get out of Russia. Yes, this is exactly in line with his long-term ambitions and objectives. So no surprise that he goes to Washington and defiles our House of Representatives and Senate with a speech that was so full of lies and misstatements that it was pathetic, but which drew the applause of many present, to their disgrace. If you ever wanted to disgrace American democracy and reveal its complicity with the Israeli genocide, Mr. Netanyahu did that. He also has done something, I think, far more important, and that is he has brought Israel to the brink of the abyss. The things he has done and the events he has set in motion risk the very existence of Israel. Many people have emigrated from Israel. I don't know the exact number, but it seems to be over 500,000. There are 2 million Israelis with second passports who are thinking about leaving. There are people in Israel who have been, a couple of hundred thousand, who have been displaced from the border areas because they're no longer secure. Israel was conceived as a safe haven for the world's Jews. It is now the most dangerous place on the planet for any Jew to live in. The Israeli economy is in free fall after the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh. The shekel, the Israeli currency, had a precipitous fall in value. The startups, which were the pride of Israel, the startup in innovative industrial ventures that made Israel great, are now moving abroad. People are not investing in Israel. And more countries are giving Israel the cold shoulder or breaking relations with it entirely. To be an Israeli in the future is to be insecure in your homeland and unwelcome abroad. This is Mr. Netanyahu's doing. And I think he will go down in history as the man who did the most to destroy Israel, his own country.
We had Bashar al-Assad visiting Russia. In your opinion, what would be the Russia official policy? Are they trying to send some sort of message to the United States that if something happens in that region, we're going to be part of that?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure at all. I do know that we have the odd situation where Mr. Kuleba, the Ukrainian foreign minister, went to China, met in Guangzhou in the south with Foreign Minister Wang Yi, his counterpart, talked about negotiations to end the war in Ukraine with Russia, but said it wasn't... those negotiations really depended on evidence from Russia of good faith. Well, that is an invitation for China to go and speak to Russia and have Russia set out its terms privately for the Ukrainians. In the meantime, Mr. Orban, who has broken rank, even though he is temporarily for 6 months the president of the European Union, is trying very hard to jumpstart a diplomatic dialogue, which has been totally missing. I had to laugh when I heard some statements from the EU that he was disrupting EU diplomacy. There is no diplomacy. He's trying to create some diplomacy. He's being widely criticized for that. But he, joined by the Slovaks, have very definite interests in an early peace. And both countries have suffered terribly historically from instability in Europe. They were both under Nazi occupation. Hungary was forced to become an ally of the Nazis, which they didn't want to do. Then they were under the occupation of the Soviet Union and forced to be an ally of the Soviet Union. They want a Europe of power balances and peace and stability, not a Europe divided between Russia and anyone else. So he's very serious. I don't think he will give up. I think he will stand up to the criticism. He may have the support of Donald J. Trump for his peacemaking efforts. We don't know what happened in his meeting in Mar-a-Lago with the former president, although they seem to be good friends. So I think a lot is happening. I don't think the Russians want to take on yet another region. They are the prime backers with Iran of the Assad government in Damascus. And I think they could escalate their support for Damascus fairly easily with little strain. They've shown an ability make small investments in Syria pay off in big terms. So I wouldn't rule it out. But I think they're very much focused on the issue of European security architecture and relationship with NATO and Ukraine, and not on the Middle East.
Yeah. The other thing that has happened was China trying to bring all these groups in Israel, in Palestine together to have some sort of agreement. And right now, with the current situation that has happened in Beirut, right now in Tehran, how would these type of assassinations affect those agreements?
Well, I don't think that affects the agreements at all. But, you know, I think there's a very important point here. And that is, you have apparently Washington, Abu Dhabi, and the Israelis talking about some kind of post-war regime for Gaza, which they would impose, and supposedly Arab troops would guarantee. I think this is utter nonsense. It's not going to go anywhere. It might have gone somewhere if Palestinians remained as divided as they were. The whole Israeli strategy over the years has been to divide and rule. But China has just brought 14 factions together under the Palestine Liberation Organization, which is the umbrella organization. This makes the Palestinian Authority, headed by Mahmoud Abbas, almost irrelevant. So I think what Beijing has just done has created a possible future government for Gaza, in which Hamas would be in a participant, but which not would not be dominated by Hamas, in which Fatah would be a participant, but which in which it would not prevail. By all accounts, any such unity government or movement under the PLO would try to elect its leaders, not have them appointed by some outside power, whether it's Israel, the United States, or Abu Dhabi.
Yeah. Just to wrap up this session, in your opinion, if we were to draw the outcome of this conflict in Gaza, the situation, the dire situation in Gaza, that Israeli were doing everything to bring the United States into the conflict. And on the other hand, we're witnessing that Shia, Sunni all together right now against yes. some sort of policy against Israel. How do you see how, at the end of the day, what would be the outcome of these type of activities of Israel so far, more than 9 months in Gaza? How would that affect Israel's future?
Israel has succeeded in uniting the opposition to it, as you suggest. Sunni and Shia are now together in the resistance movement. It has boosted the prestige and influence of Iran, which is not its intention. It has not succeeded in defeating Hamas militarily. It has instead generated a huge wave of support for Hamas among Palestinians. It has queered the Abraham Accords, which are now essentially suspended for most purposes, with countries in the Arabian Peninsula and Morocco. It has blocked, it has ruled out any normalization of relations with Saudi Arabia, which was its big prize. It has helped to make Syria, which was regarded as a pariah in the Arab world, acceptable. We see now Kuwait reestablishing an embassy, diplomatic relations with Damascus, as a most recent development. So Israel has succeeded in aligning a huge amount of opposition to itself in the region, but it has also agitated the wider Islamic world and indeed split the West. The demonstrations that have taken place for Palestinian self-determination, those are not the demonstrations for Hamas, they are demonstrations for the human rights of Palestinians and for self-determination for them. they have lo- Israel has lost the youth in the West to a great extent. And it has, I suppose it might even like this, because in the past it has carried out false flag operations to give the appearance of a surge in anti-Semitism in order to induce Jews abroad to go to Israel, make aliyah, as they say, to accept integration into the Zionist state. It may be happy that it is creating a wave of anti-Semitism. It has revived anti-Semitism, which was for all intents and purposes moribund, if not completely dead. It's now alive again. And this is nothing that any Jew abroad should be grateful for. And in fact, we see many Jews very heroically, given the pressures within Jewish communities, speaking out very bluntly and honestly about their opposition to the Zionist state and to its activities, both in Israel and elsewhere. So I think Israel has created a constellation of forces and put its very existence in jeopardy. And it shows no sign of retreating from this course. On the contrary, it is doubling down on it. Very dangerous for Israel.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Thank you, Nima. Keep well.
Have a good day.